My name is Lila, and I'm an alcoholic. And after that talk, I'm clearly an untreated Al-Anon. Oh, my God. Jesus. Just to give you a little diversity, I have no husband and no children. Thank God. Jesus. You know, you never know what you're going to end up grateful for. It's like, oh, my God. They could be drunk. They could be doing all these things. Unfortunately, I come from a large Irish family, so I have siblings and dead alcoholics all over the place. I'm delighted to be back here at Seaside. You know, I'm trying to hesitate not saying it on the tape, but you know, really, I prefer this convention almost than any other one I do. It's like, oh my God. But it's the truth, you know, it's the truth. I really like coming here. I like the people. I really enjoy coming, and I must tell you the truth. I don't enjoy always going to all of them, and I don't always get home, you know, on a cloud. But I always end up with more than I came, and it always happens to me at Seaside. And I always get delighted because, you know, Harlan always arranges it way ahead of time, and then a few months before I come, the phone rings, and I get home, and there'll be a message and say, "Hi, it's Harlan." And then I know the drums are beating in Oregon. A couple of them, 6 weeks later, it's Harlan, and Harlan's beating those drums until we come here. And you're very lucky to have that kind of thing happening here, really. Do a lot of conventions all over the country, and you're very, very fortunate. It was nice when we got into the airport. I saw Louise and Donna, and I met Bob, and... You know, normally you get a newcomer to pick you up, you know, and they're gracious, and they're, Bob, they send Bob with 20 errors, and it was great. It's the longest it's ever taken us to get from the airport to here. We stopped for lunch. We stopped at the drugstore to make sure we wouldn't catch a cold. We stopped for half and half. And then just when we were about to get here, we're with Bob, who said, you know, I've never seen a reindeer elk. And I thought, well, I've never seen one either, really. Of course, you just say that to somebody like... Al, and Al just turns the car to the left and off we are looking for reindeer elk. Only in Oregon. I'm really glad it's Friday night and I can just relax for the rest of the weekend. I mean, I'm exhausted from having listened to everybody. It's just been great. One of the gifts that I have received in my sobriety is the ability to listen. You know, comes with that a tremendous amount of responsibility. You really have to be rested when you want to listen, and it takes a lot of energy to listen. I had to run back and get a cup of coffee, and I don't even drink coffee all the time. Just so I could get up here and talk. My sobriety date is October the 1st, 1969. Frankly, I think I look terrific for that age. I'm not going anywhere for a while, but I'd like my thing right there, and I don't want the same suit as those other people are wearing. I'll send photos ahead of time, Harlan, so you can have one. I thought I'd be dead at 21. You know, it's interesting listening about all these children and things, and I rarely reflect back that far in my drinking anymore, actually. I don't even know about this fine line, Ellen, that you mentioned. If there is a line, I don't ever recall crossing it. If there was, it was right at the end of my mother's uterus because, you know, I don't recall ever drinking normally. So, born in Ireland to an Irish family, you know, you get a little whiskey in your milk to help you sleep at night. And so that you don't interfere with their drinking later on in the night. There's no children screaming in Ireland in the night. I remember after we left Ireland, we were in Canada. And I believe it was in Canada, actually, that I first set up the ironing board. And I was used to going in and out of the pubs, you know, and when I was little. And I set up an ironing board. And it's interesting, for the next few years, that ironing board grew as I grew taller. And that was my bar. And then I would wait till my mother and father were gone out, and I would find the brandy that every Irish mother always has, always. And they always put it in the same place, and it's always in the closet, and you think it's a shoebox, but it really isn't. It's the brandy for the priest. We must have had the stupidest priest, because, you know, that brandy was pure white by the time I had completely finished with it. And I would line my little brothers and sisters up. Of course, I was the oldest, and I would line them up, and I would give them little shots, you know. And I wouldn't share very much with them. They would have Coke, I would have the brandy. Forgot about that. I forgot because, you know, just for sake of time, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I arrived in a condition that, you know, now it just, I don't know. Let's see. All right. I arrived in a condition that, well, I just don't see very many people arriving anymore. In 1969, in Huntington Park at the Hole in the Ground, I was in the United States, they didn't have very many treatment centers. So, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my left side was absolutely frozen, I couldn't move my left leg, and I couldn't turn my head. And I did not come because I thought I was an alcoholic. I was just having a rough patch there, and probably an alcoholic. I mean, it certainly was in my family, and my father was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all these people we knew were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all the stuff was always happening, and I was just having a bad time. Frankly, I was desperate. I didn't even want to kill myself when I played Irish music and called Ireland in the middle of the night. I just was so gone from drinking. It affected me so severely that I had given up everything. I no longer left my apartment. I just didn't even open the drapes, and I frankly had a sense of desperation and loneliness inside of me. I didn't even want to kill myself. It just wasn't worth it, and that's the condition in which I came to you. I just wasn't worth it. Why bother killing yourself? I mean, it's supposed to happen anyway, and if I just stay holed up in here long enough, something will happen, and it did. I went stark raving mad. You know, I went stark raving mad. And you know, I think to myself, what do I have in common with, you know, you look out and you see all these people, you think, what do we really all have in common? Of course we had the disease of alcoholism, or we wouldn't be able to tolerate each other for all these 37 years. But not the disease, and then we've got all these Al-Anons to make sure they remind us of what it was really like. And, you know, so we're constantly in touch with, you know, what it was like. But, you know, I know what I have in common with people other than the drinking, because sometimes you can get removed from it. You know, one of the most important things we have in common are bathroom floors. I understand what it feels like to hit that floor. I understand what it feels like to spend a couple of days on a bathroom floor. I have had my greatest intimate relationship with porcelain. Climbing up that porcelain, feeling that incredible sense of coolness against my cheek. You know, it was really like, oh, this is it. I had nothing else that I aspired to do but just get that cold porcelain against that body and, you know, get up as high as maybe the mirror so that I could look in that mirror and determine how fast it was moving. And because of how fast it was moving, I would be able to determine whether or not I was going to fall back down. And if it was still enough, I could stand up and I could start again. And I drank like that. I just drank like that. I thought I was a social drinker. I actually functioned. I was dying for a while there from alcoholism and potential at exactly the same time. It helps to have brains and, you know, be able to. And I was out there, and then all of a sudden, the alcoholism won. And one day, I just gave up. I just gave up. Just like I gave up on everything, I gave up. You know, I used to say, well, never lose my car. And then, you know, I'd start to lose my car. And then I just gave up on the damn car. You know, and then I would say, well, I'm going to meet you at such and such a time. And I was like Ellen and said, I never showed up. I became my own best company after a while. And I didn't even want you there. I certainly didn't want to share anything with you. You know, drugs were not a very big deal for me. First of all, it was 1969, 1960, 1965, 1966. You know, they had Life magazine articles that if you took anything, you'd end up in some loony bin for the rest of your life. That was pretty scary. And besides, when you close the drapes and, you know, the police would actually come, you know, just for marijuana. It was like ridiculous. But I used to get paranoid smoking that stuff. And all it did is make me nervous and hungry. It made me really hungry. I had this passion for tacos. I could eat a dozen tacos, you know, a shot of whiskey and a little marijuana, and I was eating a dozen tacos. Now, the bad part about that is I drove drunk to the taco stand, which was the favorite taco stand of all the police in West Covina, California. And, you know, it was just horrible. And they, you know, half those police, you know, they liked it when I relax and untangle the voice of the countries I've been in. You know, I would get drink and I would have this huge Irish accent, and they would just take me home and, you know, tell me their mother was Irish and their grandmother was Irish and where from Ireland. And that really saved me from being arrested. So I had none of those things happen to me. What happened to me is that I was lucky enough at a very young age that alcoholic poisoning attacked my body and froze my body. Now, you know, for about 2 months before I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, that was a bit of a problem, because when you can't move your head, you can't drink out of the bottle the way you normally do on your side of the bed. So I had to move to the other side of the bed, and I had to move all these things around. And I realize now, when I look back on those simple things, how much work and effort and energy I put into drinking. And how much of a ritual it was for me. Even when I couldn't turn my head, it was still important that the bottle be on the right side of the bed, that everything be proper. That was, you know, way after I'd given up my stool at the bar, you know, You know, I would look in that mirror and I would see, as the night went on, I would be taller, my hair would be straighter, I would look more, you know, Californian, and, you know, I would be looking at you, looking at me, and then we would drink and talk to each other, and I would lie to you, and you would lie to me, and we would believe it, you know, and I would make these things up. I thought, oh my God, how can I possibly do that? But I recall when I was a very little tiny girl sticking my head through the banisters over my Aunt Lila and Uncle Neil's pub, and I would see these people down there, you know, and they would come in, and one of them would drink a while, and then they would start crying, just spontaneously crying, and I would think, geez, that's ridiculous. And then other people would be talking to each other, and I heard one guy one time tell this other guy that he wrote a book, and I thought, he's the butcher. He's never even graduated high school. I know he hasn't written a book. And the other guy's telling me he flew planes. They didn't fly planes. Aer Lingus was practically not off the ground. And they were lying to each other. And these are people in the town. And like everybody knew they were lying. And then another guy would come in, and within 20 minutes he would be in a fight and they would kick him out. And this happened all of the time. Little did I know that the reason I probably enjoyed watching it was my yet. And that I did all of those things. I can't believe it. You know, all the yets happened to me. The good news is I was young. The good news is it attacked my body. The really good news is that I gave up and I lost hope. The really good news is I became so desperate and so lonely I couldn't leave my little tiny apartment. And I lived in an apartment building with all these other alcoholics. You know, I find them, we find each other. It was not uncommon for me to come home. I remember coming home one night and finding a person floating in the pool, upside down, clearly gone, in the pool. It interfered with my drinking. I thought, Jesus, why do I have to be the person to notice this person in the pool? I mean, where is everybody else? I'm in a hurry. I have these bags, and I've got to get in there into my place so that I can lock myself in there and do whatever the ritual of that night was for me, whatever it was, you know, and I felt bad about that. So I rushed up the stairs to the only Al-Anon in the building. His name was Cliff. He took care of all of us drunks, and I said, Cliff, so-and-so is floating in the pool. And he said, well, you know, that's bound to have happened. You know, those alcoholics are. What the hell happened? I said, I don't know, but she's in the pool. And somebody's got to handle it, because I don't want to handle it. And even though I couldn't handle it, and I was a raging alcoholic, I thought I could handle it. But I really wanted Cliff to handle it, because it was more important that night that I drank, because I was a little on edge, you see, when I got home. And I thought better when I drank, and I calmed down when I drank. And I needed to get in there, and I needed to have a drink, because in about 20 more minutes, I was going to get this kind of pain in my hip. It would first start in my hip, and then I would get a pain that felt like a big toothache that would go up the right side of my head. And I had about 4 or 5 minutes to convince this guy that he had to get that woman and help her in the pool. You know, what happened to her is that she was an alcoholic. I had sat by that pool many afternoons getting drunk with her, and she choked on a cigarette. She's having a cigarette at the side of the pool. Don't ask. Went in, I don't know what happened first. Well, Obviously, she must have choked on the cigarette first and flipped into the pool. And, you know, but it wasn't uncommon, and that's the kind of, that's where I ended up, basically. Do I have to tell you anything else, really? I mean, is it necessary to go any further? You know, I drank anything that was brown. If I ran out of anything that was brown, I drank anything that was white. If there was nothing that was white, I drank anything at all. It didn't really matter. I just thought I had a preference. You know, I had all these little accoutrements and bottles and stuff. I really prided myself on never drinking wine. I just didn't think it worked fast enough. And, you know, one night, so I had all this wine stuff, too. You know, some sort of, I don't know, iron grate thing with all these expensive wines in it. And, I don't know, I just figured if you had expensive wine, you weren't an alcoholic. If you had Gallo, you were an alcoholic. If you had expensive wine, you weren't an alcoholic. And I would never drink this wine. And then one day I woke up and I had drunk all of the wine. Not even a bottle left of the wine. And then I had this obsessive thing that I would go around the house if I had just like one or two people over. Then, you know, the next day after everybody was gone, I would pour all the remains of their drinks, there was never one left for me, and into a container, put a cap on it, and I would put it in the refrigerator, and I'd leave it in there for about, you know, 30 days. And then I would take it out, and I would open it up. That stuff, that's why I ended up paralyzed, really. I probably could have gotten another 10 years out of this thing if I wasn't drinking that goddamn stuff I concocted myself in the refrigerator. I'm out there running up all these charges. I could have bought the stuff. I wasn't completely bankrupt, didn't I? I was bankrupt till I got sober and found out, oh, well, thought I paid those bills, guess not. You know, what are you going to do? Hadn't cut me off yet, but I was making my own hooch in the refrigerator. That's all I had in there. Amazing. I haven't thought of those things in a long time. I'm all by myself in the house doing all this, you know. Oh, my God. I was shocked about the wine, okay? It did enter my mind that somebody that drank 6, 8, 7 bottles of wine, something was wrong with them. Something was wrong that I drank that, and I wasn't exactly sure how many days it took me to drink that. I just knew a little bit of time had gone by. I wasn't sure because I was no longer coming out, and you see, it didn't matter anymore if I ever came out. I stopped talking to people. I had stopped answering the phone. It didn't really matter anymore. I had enough. I had enough, and I just hoped that somehow, miraculously, I would be dead before I ran out. That's all. And I really had the insanity of the alcoholic. I really believed that that was going to happen to me. You see, I believe that this disease is centered in our minds way before we ever join Alcoholics Anonymous. Who else would go to this much trouble? Who else would think, oh, well, maybe I'll die first, and if I don't die, then I'll be fine, you know? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Now, this little Al-Anon Cliff, he had tried with me once, you know, and he called me up and he tried to trick me. He said, I know that your family knows people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got this drunk here in unit number whatever, and would you mind arranging to take her to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, oh, look, Cliff, you know, I can't be going back to those meetings now because, you know, I, out of respect, I would never drink in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. We just wouldn't do it, but I wouldn't drink out of a bottle or anything. But I did take the coffee out to the car, put the whiskey in the coffee, come back in, and I passed out, and, you know, I was just embarrassed. You know, I just thought there was, like, only 2 meetings in all of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everybody would know, you know, that it was me. I said, listen, Cliff, I'm not sure about that, but I'll tell you what, I'll call for them. And anyway, I ended up, whatever, I called this guy George, great man. I called George at, I now know, knew George, he's passed on, at central office, and he answered the phone, and I said, listen, George, I know all about Alcoholics Anonymous. My family are either drunk or they're on AA, and there's this woman here in this building, and this guy wants her to go to a meeting. Can you guys, like, send somebody out here? She desperately needs help, and could you, like, arrange that? Because I really don't want to have anything to do with going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at all. And he said, you're not an alcoholic. I said, oh, no, certainly I am not an alcoholic. Listen, George, I'm just not an alcoholic. Right now I'm a little high-strung. Things are not going right, but I am not an alcoholic. And he said, do you drink in the morning? I said, of course I don't drink in the morning. Alcoholics drink in the morning. He said, but it sounds to me like you're drinking now. I said, I know, but it's Saturday morning. Saturday and Sunday. They don't count on... doesn't everybody drink on Saturday and Sunday morning? That is like, that is really, that's why I don't have anything I want to do with you guys. You're just too rigid. I mean, that's just... He said, well, you know, could you possibly pour that drink out now? I said, you know, George, I don't really want to go through this, but if you insist, I certainly can. Because I knew I had the stuff I'd made just like 2 weeks ago. I said, be happy to do that. Do you want to hear it, George? Do you want to hear it? Now, that was a very big deal because we didn't have portable phones, cell phones, things you're hopped up to all the time. You know, so he said, okay, go pour it out, blah, 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 blah. I went, I came back and I poured it out. And, you know, he said to me, I can't believe the man told the truth. But, you know, in 1969, it was a lot different than it is today. They told, they were a lot more, we weren't so, people weren't worried about hurting newcomers' feelings. You know, what the hell? What's the worst thing that can happen to a newcomer? They're going to get drunk and come back. You know what I mean? I don't know. Where the hell are they going to go? They're going to die, go to an institution, or come back. You know? So he said to me, listen, kid, you're an alcoholic. I said, Jesus, I don't know who the hell you are. Who are you to tell me I'm an alcoholic? Do you have any idea who I am? Blah, 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 blah. He said, you're an alcoholic. Do you think you cannot drink today? I said, well, I don't think I think I can get, I don't have to drink today. He said, because if you can get through today without drinking, call us around 6 o'clock this evening and we'll come and take you to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Great. Profanity, and I hung up. And I thought, geez, you know, this is, I might be an alcoholic. And so I went and I lay down on the couch, and I think I passed out. At about 5 o'clock, I came about, and the phone rang. It was a friend of mine, one of the one friends I had left. One, you know, you always one, you always have one that's left, one that's worse off than you. The one that you can say, now that is an alcoholic. And you have got to do something about your drinking. But right now, they're expecting us at the blah, blah, blah. Can you drive? Because I can't drive and whatever, you know. Then you tell somebody you think is a worse alcoholic than you are to drive. Actually, that night she did drive oh, God. Drove up into a hospital parking structure in Hollywood and the barrier went right through the barrier and... I couldn't believe it, and then jumped out of the car while it was running. I thought, Jesus, I can't hang around with these alcoholics. You know, I just got out of the car and walked away. Just walked away, and then, thank God, ran into another old-time alcoholic friend of mine down on Hollywood and Vine there, and they took me to some place, and I forgot about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think about Alcoholics Anonymous again. I didn't think about Alcoholics Anonymous again until one night when I knew that I wanted to die and I couldn't kill myself. Oh, I had tried, like, you know, I'm not the dying type. I don't know, you know. You would think that somebody would just get a bunch of alcohol and a bunch of pills and kill themselves. Oh, no. We might hurt each other or something. I remember one night, oh, God, I took all night to do this. It was during, there was Borax was a product then, that's how old it goes, Borax and Thyme and all these cleaning products, and I lined them all up on the kitchen floor and I put these, and how did I have all these chef knives, don't ask, but I had 6 or 7 chef knives, and I stacked them up facing up between all these cleaning products. You know, it's one of those dive apartments that you end up in the middle of mid-Wilshire, you know, drunken building, tiny little narrow space in the kitchen, and it took all night, and I lined them all up, and I thought, great. I'm going to get a chair, and I'm going to stand on the chair, and I'm going to, like, fall forward. I'm just going to fall on all these knives, and if I can just, like, do a really direct hit, then I'll just die instantly. Then I won't feel anything, and nothing, God forbid, I should hurt myself as I'm dying. I honestly, God, don't know what happened, because I just woke up the next morning, and the knives were still there, and I thought, oh, what the hell was that, you know? I must have been trying to hurt myself, and... Then I got a call from a cousin in Ireland who said, Jesus, are you still alive? You called us last night and said you were going to fall on 6 knives. And that's how you can piece those stories together, you know. And then the first thing they do when they know you're sober at least 3 months is they tell you everything. You know, like, oh, my God, you know. So anyway, I didn't die. But within that same week, I went to bed. Within that same week, one night, I went to bed. And it was an odd kind of night, you know, because I couldn't get drunk that night. No matter how much I drank, I could not get drunk. Oh, it was a horrible time. It was a horrible time. I couldn't get drunk, and I tried. Oh, God, I tried. I tried brandy. I tried everything. I really was desperate. And I knew that I was losing my mind. I was gone. And by now, I'd just gotten used to dragging my leg after me, and I got used to the stiff neck. It didn't bother me at all. And I got used to living in the same pajamas and the same coat. You know, God. Same outfit for probably weeks by then. And I really wasn't eating. Nothing to eat. Didn't care if I ever ate again. And I just knew something was desperately, desperately, desperately different that night. Something was screaming inside of me that didn't have a voice. I don't know if you relate to that. But I also knew that if there was any soul at all, if there was any possibility, and I was not a very religious person, I went to a cathedral once, stoned out and drunk as can be, and a statue winked at me, and yeah. So I lit a few candles, the thing went, hey. Too close. Didn't go back. But I knew that if there was any life, the soul had to be somewhere, you know, and you're taught by all those nuns, you know, that you have a soul. I figured it had to fit in, you know, in there somewhere, probably the size of a good baseball and softball. And mine was all marked up because, you know, mortal sins, you just don't get to erase them, so have them forever. And venials, I don't know, they disappear after a while, I suppose, but I thought, what's the point? And I just imagined if there was a little tiny candle in that soul, mine was on the flickering end of it, and it was going to go out. And here I am, drinking and drinking, trying to be drunk, trying to get away, trying to escape this reality, trying to leave and get away, and I couldn't do it, and I could sense that the light was going out, and I could almost feel it flickering. And I was so lonely. I was so desperately lonely. And I was so desperate. And I just didn't want to do it anymore. You see, I couldn't do it anymore. Whatever imagined responsibility I had put upon myself, it was too much for me. I couldn't get up one more day and smile and pretend that everything was all right. I couldn't say hello to you and think it was going. I couldn't do it. I didn't have an hello left in me. I had nothing. There was nothing there, and I couldn't even get drunk, and this silent scream was coming inside of me. And I remember laying down in the bed, and I looked up at the ceiling, and everything went crazy, and I did some damage to my face, and I saw these, and I don't know if I've even talked about this now for years and years, and I saw these things on the ceiling, and I actually went out of my mind, and I saw this huge white light in the corner coming down the hallway. I actually never have talked about this for about 20 years, coming down the hallway, a huge light, and I thought, this must be it, you know, this is it, I'm dying, or if I'm not dead already, and I was so grateful to be taken out of this life. I was just so grateful. And for the first time in my life, I found myself praying, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for taking me. Thank you. I've got to go. I've just got to go. And then the light went away. And then I was back. And the phone rang. I had to find the phone. I found it in the refrigerator. I don't even know how I heard it, because I put it in there not to have to hear it. Anyway, I finally found the phone, and it was my mother. And I hadn't seen my mother in, oh God, a long time, since I had almost killed the whole family in the car. And, you know, what's the point of going out there? You just get the lecture. And she said, you know, Lila, you're just like your father. You're an alcoholic, and you're going to die from the disease of alcoholism. And if you want help or someone to help you, let me know. And she hung up the phone. And I thought, well, I probably am an alcoholic right now, not forever. So I got the Yellow Pages and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the middle of the night and nobody answered then. And it was the first time in my life, for any reason whatsoever, I had ever asked for help. Ever. I was the kind of alcoholic that listened to the songs about how you're going to climb a mountain by yourself, and I had intended to make enough money so that I could own an island and no one would ever get on it. No monkeys, nothing, nobody. Nothing. And that was my goal in life, you know, all this power and money. And Alcoholics Anonymous didn't answer. And I remember, this is all in the same night, and I remember throwing that telephone book across the room and saying, you know, that's what it is, you see, you son of a bitch, you God. When I ask for help, you're not there. There is no God. And besides, I don't want help from anybody, not a single solitary soul. I will never, ever, ever ask for help. And the next morning when I was climbing up that bathroom sink and grabbing that porcelain, I heard myself come out of a state of unconsciousness saying, oh God, please help me. Oh God, please help me. And I was enraged that I had asked God to help me. I was enraged. And I remember pulling the towel rack out of the wall thinking, no, 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 no one's going to help me. I don't want anybody's help. And I don't remember what happened in the next few days. I only remember that I called my mother. And I said, I need some help. I'd like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want it to be with anyone we know. The stipulation. So, you know, anyway, I ended up going to the hole in the ground in Huntington Park on October 1st of 1969. And when I walked in that door and fell down those steps, get down those steps, in the door, I don't know. It's the reason I'm standing here tonight. Nothing really changes, really. My God, my clock stopped. How unfortunate for you. I don't want to wear my glasses, and of course I have this huge watch now that doesn't have the right, if the lights doesn't shine on it properly, I can't see it with all this bloody gold. I got all that money sober, by the way. I almost did it again. Isolated myself sober. Shocking. We really just get sober, don't we? Just stop drinking and then we bring ourselves here. And we think just because we stopped drinking, everything changed. Shock. It's not true. It takes a while. Okay. Bear with me because I don't want to. It's the Al-Anon me. It's a little bit of control here over the time. I feel I can say that now. My sister's on Al-Anon for 22 years, or 26 or something like that. Anyway, needless to say, I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came down that stairway, into the stairs, and where the way it used to be then, I looked across this room and I saw this little handful of men. One guy was in a suit, you know. He had a white shirt and a black suit, and that's all he ever wore, you know. Duke, oh my God, I miss him and his sister. All he wore was this suit, he was sitting there, you know, and I knew him, and I didn't care at that point because I really had a hard time getting down those steps. I had a hard time getting out of the car. I got dressed in a really expensive outfit so nobody would think I was an alcoholic. Then I drove to Huntington Park to a place called the Hole in the Ground, like, you know, and showed up for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because I wasn't an alcoholic, mind you. And there was another guy there, and then they used to have these big buckle belts. Well, you guys would understand that. Your names are J-E-R-T and J-R and cowboy hats, and there's one of those belts right there, and all this hair and stuff, and I thought, Jesus, this is not for me, you know, this is not for me, and this guy just caught me at the end of the steps, and then they take you to the front row. You know, they used to have a row for newcomers, and you knew that that was the row because every other seat was a big book on it, and they took you to the front row, and there was another guy in the front row, and he was, you know, moving all around, and then they kind of evaluated you immediately. They immediately evaluated you. There was a signal that went between these people that was some sort of, I don't know, little secret language of old-timers, you know. They would just look at you and nod to each other and make a sign, and then they would run out with this Coca-Cola or a donut, you know, a jelly donut the size of this podium, and they would say, you know, eat this donut and drink this Coke as fast as you can. And a Hershey bar, and then they would maybe give you this much coffee, and I think, what the hell is this about? You know, the sugar, and the sugar, and the sugar, and of course we all know what it was about, you know what it was about. A couple of days later, I'm back now, I'm like, there are 3 days, I have my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm coming a little bit early because I don't want anybody else to take my seat. I certainly don't want the guy that's shaking all over the place to be moved over one. So, you know, right away I'm becoming a member of Alcoholics Anonymous by participating. I don't hear a word that they're saying from the podium. So, you know, I'm one of those kind of people that got sober because of the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I felt it in the room, because I smelled it. I smelled the similarity. I could sense the similarity. It was in my heart. It was in my spirit. I knew who you were. I knew when these guys would be mumbling up there, and I went to prison, and I killed five people, and now I got a, you know, two kids, five dogs, a house, a car, a Cadillac. You know, I think I'd like the Cadillac. The rest you can... And I would hear these little things, and another guy would say, I have this hole, and the wind would be going through me, and I would think, oh, wow, I have that, you know. And then I would be looking around the room, and I would think, God, I still have my teeth. Do I qualify, you know? And I saw the signs, you know, easy does it, and I would think, what the hell does that mean? And I would say to the guy beside me, do you know what these things mean? What do they mean? Like, easy does it. Now, all this was going on while the meeting was going on, mind you. We're talking to each other openly while the meeting was going on. These guys didn't care. We were all drunks at that time. Everybody wasn't coming in all buffed up and wonderful. We were shaking. I had DTs sitting at the hole in the ground in Huntington Park in the front row. I had more severe DTs in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in my first 30 days than I ever did drunk. I used to see things coming out of the ceilings of the meeting room, think, whoa, look at that. Wow, the colors are really, wow. And I was not a drug addict. I was just an alcoholic. And then, you know, all these dead people would, like, fly by, you know, like, whoa, Jesus, look at, I didn't know, was she dead? I have to ask my mother, oh my God. Now, the only thing that made me feel totally comfortable was there were other people on my row doing the same thing. They were, oh, whew. Am I getting out of the way of my people or your people or who the hell are those people? Serious as can be, you know, still didn't quite get it. Now, did the hand of God touch me on the shoulder and go, bing, this is going to be one of Jesus' little sunbeams and you're going to be sober for the rest of your life? No, God was not part of my equation. Was I coming because I identified with just the nutsness in the meeting, the anxiety, the nervousness, the people in my row? You know, yes, I was. That's why I was coming. Was I coming because I was getting nervous if I didn't have a Hershey bar? Stuff would happen to me. I would start to feel like, ooh, this is not good. Oh, you know, I get these little headaches. And then one day the guy beside me, Mr. Jigger, he was like, he was worse than usual. And I said, Jesus, I mean, have you had your Hershey bar and Coke tonight? I mean, what's going on? I said, you know, I think we're supposed to, be on this stuff every night, 8:30, get the cookies, get the... And besides, I can't be looking at you tonight. I have a commitment. They actually gave me the cookie commitment, right away. How stupid, you know? I went out and borrowed money to buy cookies because I thought the cookies needed to be really elegant. I brought in these lace things from Ireland. I lined them all up. This is at this joint. And I put them all. And then if you touched a cookie, I resented it because I had them in triangles and squares. And my best marketing genius was going into all of these cookies. They just removed me from the job. And then I got sugar cubes, putting out sugar cubes. Somebody said, you're lucky you don't get the ash can thing, you know. The worst job in the whole place was the ashtrays, because everybody smoked. In fact, they told us when we got sober, do you smoke? Well, yes. Well, smoke more. Smoke more, drink more coffee, you never die from lack of sleep. Totally not true, really. Another couple of days, I probably would have died from all of that, but I didn't. And what happened to the guy beside me was a spiritual experience of a kind for me, because the night came where I was sitting there, I had finished my commitment, I was just getting with it, you know, just beginning to hear what people were saying. I was just beginning to realize that I was going to stay for 3 weeks, 3 weeks only, and then I would be back. And this time I wouldn't make all the same mistakes, you know, I would drink in a different place, I would eat first, and I would have mashed potatoes and a steak, and I just knew all the things that I could do, and it was just going to be better, and besides, Jesus, I am an alcoholic, and another person in my head would say, yes, you are an alcoholic, and then another voice would say, no, you're not. And another one would say, well, what the hell are you doing here if you're not an alcoholic? Well, I don't know. I can't get the hell out. The door's too far away. And another voice would say, of course you're an alcoholic. Your whole family are alcoholics. You're an alcoholic. Lila, you're going to die. Who the hell are you to tell me I'm not going to die? Now, I had 18 of these people talking to me all the time. How was I supposed to hear somebody from the podium? It was not possible. So I understand, by the grace of God, if you're a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous, or you're just nervous, or you're upset, or whatever it is, you're going to be okay. Don't worry about it. Everybody says, do what we tell you. I didn't hear what they told me to do. Ollie just knew that when they went out, they said, be here tomorrow at this time. That's what I did. I was assigned an interim sponsor. What did that person say? They said, look, this is my job. Took me over to the thing, said, here's the big book. You got to take this home and you got to read it. You got to read it. Every page, you got to read it. You know, some little newcomer nut tells you to read. And then I said to Duke, this is just not a possible. I can't do that. And he said, sure you can. You're going to need to read that book. And they give you all this literature. They tell you to drink the coffee. They tell you when to come back. They tell you, make sure you have a dime in your pocket. My phone call was a dime. Make sure you have a dime in your pocket at all times. At all times, make sure you have a dime. And I'm like, I've got to have a dime. Got to have a dime. And, you know, it's not like we had cell phones or anything, you know. And then call us before you drink. Call us before you drink. So I knew every phone booth, everywhere there was a phone booth between my house and every meeting that I went to, because I was so worried that between phone booths I wouldn't get to the meeting. And I had the dime, and I was like ready to go with this dime. And so I did everything they told me. Everything they told me. I think newcomers will do everything they tell you. It just depends on your level of desperation. I was totally desperate. That didn't mean that there wasn't another person in my head saying, 2 weeks to go and you're out of here. And then another person saying, oh, thank God, I really think I'm an alcoholic. Oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. And I would go back to that apartment and all the lights were on because I was afraid to be in the dark by myself. I actually slept in the living room. I faced all the furniture toward the front door because I knew in the middle of the night they were coming in to get me. And then when I had it facing the front door, I thought, they're coming through the walls. They're coming through the walls. I can hear the drills now. Now, that's the condition I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in. I believe for the one person that I came here tonight, the one person, that's what Duke said to me. He said, you are the one person we've been waiting for tonight. You are that person. I never forgot that. So I'm always look, whether I'm speaking or not speaking, for the one person who can't even hear me, but knows what the hell is she doing up there with all that passion. She must be an alcoholic. She's me. I can understand that. Oh, my God, that identification. It's all we have, that feeling, all that laughter, all that energy, all that stuff. That's what I lived on. That's what I lived on until I could start to hear the words, until I could start to understand that easy does it means just slow it down, Lila. It's okay. First things first, put one foot in front of the other. Get up in the morning and make your bed, they would say to you. Make your bed so you don't get back into it. Make your bed so you don't get back into it. Put the cap back on the toothpaste. Put that cap back on the toothpaste. Why is that important, I would say? What the hell does that mean? Put your cap back on the toothpaste. Because drunks don't put their cap back on the toothpaste. And it's a habit. It's a habit. And you have. And I understood that I had the habit of drinking. I had a ritual and a habit of my drinking, and I needed to have a sober habit. I had to have habits of sobriety. I didn't know at the beginning when they were telling me all of these silly little things that that's what it would be. They told me that when I got home at night and if I couldn't sleep, that I have to take a bath, eat a banana, and read the big book. And I would say, well, what page? I remember calling Duke one night and saying, that's it. I can't stay on Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to kill myself for real this time. I'm sober, and I really know I want to die. Now, I'm going to tell you something, Duke. All the years that I was drinking, short as they were, I thought about killing myself. It was all drama. I never really wanted to do it. But now I'm sober. I'm sober, and I want to die. Where is that in your big book? And he said, have you eaten the banana? I said, well, no. Call me back when you eat the banana. All right. The banana. And run a bath, he said. Got in the bath. Got the book. What page, Duke? What page is it? I had a lot of extension cords to get that phone into the bathroom because I was a member of AA. And he said, Lila, any page will do. Any page will do, any meeting will do, any person will do, anybody will do as long as they are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Any page will do because that's the page you're supposed to read. 37 and plus years later, 20 years later, I was in New York City. I had all this stuff. All this stuff. I'm in this huge big car, charge of this company. I got all these people counting on me. I get into that car. We're driving down. It's one-way street, as you know, probably in New York. I'm in the car, and all of a sudden, I say to the guy, oh, my God, And I am known for my calmness because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Not everybody knows, but they just know, she's really kind of calm. And you know, we can count on Lila and one of these kind of people. And I go mad in the car. And I said, turn the car around. And the guy said, what are you talking about? This is a one. I said, I don't care. Turn the goddamn car around. And my right arm said to me, you know, what is the problem with you? I said, I left the cap off the toothpaste. This is a crisis here. I don't think I put the cap on the toothpaste. Oh, my God. I got, turn the car around. Well, you know, I said, turn the car. Anyway, needless to say, we turned the car around. I ran around. Why? Would I have gotten drunk that day if I didn't put the cap back on the toothpaste? Probably not. But was I going to break one habit that had guaranteed me sobriety and been part of my sobriety for 20 years? You damn not. I have never missed a day of putting my cap back on the toothpaste. I make my bed every single morning when I get out of that bed. And I'm going to tell you, in my 12th year and my 15th year and my 20th year and my 30th year, when life happens, when we're on Alcoholics Anonymous and we're doing what we need to do, when you work the steps haphazardly any old way you want to for the first few years, because whatever, and then you find out maybe they're written in an order because that's how you're supposed to do it, 1 through 12. Maybe they make sense that way. And then I finally ended up doing that. And maybe you realize that in the darkness of your soul, which will come back, because I found out that the person inside of me, just because I wasn't drinking, it needed to grow. It needed to change. And it was the example of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, conversations in Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, being available in Alcoholics Anonymous, showing up, putting the cap in the toothpaste, making my bed. Years later, when I was depressed and didn't want to get out of that bed, when I didn't want to get out of bed, when I didn't want to get up because life was too hard and I was sober, I got up because I knew how to get up and make the bed. I got up and I took a shower and I called that person and I did all of those kinds of things. When I had a baby once and she called and she said, I can't move, I can't breathe, I said, we'll breathe together. You breathe with me. Are you ready? Let's just start breathing. Did you get up, make your bed, take a shower, call me back, have a slice of toast, call me back? Why? Because somebody had done that for me. Every little habit, these silly little things, reading any page will do, making the commitments. I finally ended up with the ASHRAE commitment. I don't know why, but I thought it was a punishment. But even doing that makes me do things now, all these years later, that I normally wouldn't want to do. But I'm used to doing things that I don't want to do because at the beginning, I took all of that direction. Do we want you when we sponsor you to do things because we are important? No, absolutely not. It's a humbling experience, really, to sponsor somebody. I just want you to do what we suggest so that you get in the habit of taking direction. Because at 3 o'clock in the morning, if you are so lucky, you will have a spiritual crisis and maybe sometime in your future, maybe not. Some people, believe it or not, never have them. Never, I don't understand it. But somewhere along the way, people like me, seekers, who turned their head away from God and said, I don't need a God, I will never need a God. Well, you know what? My body got well and my emotions got well, and you know what? I found out that I was spiritually sick. I found out that I stayed sober long enough to find out how sick I really, truly am. And when I found out how sick I truly am, I got lonely again in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had all this money and all this stuff, and it didn't fill anything up. It didn't fill anything up, and I was sober as a judge walking around Alcoholics Anonymous, wondering, why am I lonely again? And then I started to think. You see, it's a disease of the mind. It's centered in the mind. And if you're one day sober, and even if I'm this many years sober, if I make a decision to drink tonight, I will make that decision stone cold sober. So the person, the mind that I have that makes that decision has to be spiritually fit. I have to be spiritually fit all the time. I can't have one single day go by where I'm not spiritually fit. I can't risk it. The longer I'm sober, the more important it is. As I have gotten sober, you know, when you're a newcomer, you get all this attention, blah, 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 newcomer, 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 most important person in the room, blah, 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 blah. Sometimes I'm not so sure about that. Sometimes I think the most important person in the room is the old-timer who continues to come, sit in the same seat week after week after week after week after week. That's the most important person. Somebody that's an example. Somebody that's living life. But you know who has the rough time in here? Not the newcomers, not the old-timers, the comers. When you're just a comer, you're no longer excited about being here. They don't even like you that much. You don't like them either. You've already raised up all your rage. You know, you're sitting in the back room blowing off heads as a pastime in the meetings. You know, You're gossiping. You're doing all the things. You know, you're in the danger zone. You're in the desert years. You're in the years where you have to stay close. You're in the years where you have to be communicating to the same person over and over and over and over again. You're in the years when you have to look at that 12 and 12 and you have to read it. You're in the years where you have to look at the book and you have to take a bath and you have to eat a banana and you have to put the cap back on that toothpaste over and over and over again. You're in the years when every single thing you learned in your first year counts. Everything. And then you know why it counts even more when you're 20 and 30 and 25 and 30 and 35 years sober? Because by then you're in life. You're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you're also a member of the human race. You're no longer running away. To me, the most horrifying thing that could possibly happen to me is not having reality. I can't imagine. I fear for the day that I have a serious illness, but I'll have somebody help me with that medication because I will be under the influence the minute I take something, and I will want them to help me so that I can get back as quickly as I can to reality, to where it's safe, to where I know and to where I understand, and so that I can go to my meetings and I can look you in the eye, I can feel you. Has everybody been wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous? No, there's some real jerks out here. You're going to run into them. Don't let them cause you to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I had somebody embezzle from me when I was 21 years sober. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I'll help him with his business. He's 21 years sober. We all have wings and angel wings when we're 21. No, the guy's a crook. Did he drink? He didn't drink. There's lots of, you're going to run into all kinds of people, good, bad, and indifferent in Alcoholics Anonymous. You have a seat. If you're sitting in one tonight and you're sober, no one can take it away from you. Don't let them do it. Don't let anybody or anything ever exclude you from Alcoholics Anonymous. There's Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world. You're going to find all kinds of personalities in Alcoholics Anonymous. Great. Lots of people need them. You will too. And then you'll have the night of the soul where you need to pray to your God of your own understanding. Where you'll say that the first step, that you are powerless over whatever is going on in that head of yours, and that your life is unmanageable, and you will feel it in your stomach and it just won't feel right. And you'll know it's not right, and you don't even have to explain it, because you'll have the second step to go to, and you'll be honest enough to say to yourself, look, I've got to call somebody because something's not right with me, and I'm going to the second step, and I can get all the hope I can possibly have from that second step, because it's worked for me before. It's worked for me before. And you can go to the third step and get some faith. And if you have enough honesty and hope and faith, well, then you're going to have the courage to take a fourth step and find out what's in the way. What is in the way? What is in the way of what has always been given to me in all the years that I have been sober? I am in the way. And then I'll talk to somebody in five, and I'll have enough integrity to listen to them, and so that they can tell me the truth and say, you know, Lila, we've got to have to take another look at this. This has come up before. Perhaps you're not being honest enough with yourself. And if I am powerless in one and get that power back in two, and I have that faith, and faith is an interesting thing, you know. Faith is what I lost when I was in my 18th and 20th year, when I didn't know whether I trusted a God, or I didn't even believe if there was a God. And in the last 18 years, I can tell you that I have a God of greater understanding than I've ever had before. I, like the speaker this morning, can't explain that God. If I could explain that God, it wouldn't be big enough for me. I'm an alcoholic. It's a God of beyond my explanation. It's a God that's a combination of everything I wish and everything I want. It's my sister who's gone, who I need to talk to every now and then, and my uncles and my grandmother and anybody I want. It's a whole bunch of people that have died in the last few years that was my sponsor. And because I know how to show up when she called and she said, I'm dying, and I only have so much time to go, and I said, what can I do? And she said, well, I think what you can do, you can't do what I need you to do, because I need somebody to come up here now to Washington, Mount Olympic, Washington, right away, and spend a few days with me till my brother comes. And I was on the plane that afternoon. That afternoon, how could I repay her for what she had given so freely to me? And because I can do that, I don't leave a hotel room with a towel on the ground, because I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that you leave everywhere better than you found it. I will not have somebody pick up a towel for me when I can reach down and pick it up myself. Where would you get these kind of ethics unless you were a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Where would you learn these tiny, weeny little things? These small, important little things to make sure that the person has the bigger slice of pie than you. To take the extra second to ensure that they have a dollar in their pocket when they go home so that they can stop off and get a burger. The little sensitivities that were done to me that I can now do to other people. The small things. It humbles me to speak in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stopped speaking as much as I did because I got into it there for a while. I thought, oh, started giving the same old talk. I thought, Lila, this is not what your life is going to be about. Your life is going to be for the one person in the room that needs to know if you stay sober, you will have the courage to be who you are whenever you choose to be, whoever you are, however you feel on any given day, and be willing to say, this is who I am today. My name is Lila. I am an alcoholic. Everything else is up for grabs, but I'm going to tell you, as a result of my putting one foot in front of the other, first things first, easy does it, this too shall pass, but for the grace of God. The grace of God, well, the will of God will not take you, or the grace of God will not keep you. What if I hadn't read that? What if I didn't know that after every page I read, every page would do? What if I didn't know to take a bath to wash away the sorrow? What if I didn't know when they lived and when they died and when there was joy and when there was happiness? What if I didn't know all of those things? What if I hadn't experienced them and listened to other people go through them? We just take from each other and then we realize, oh my God, you gave me a gift. I didn't even know it. The small things. The small things. My house is neat because I'm neat. I'm neat because I'm not a drunk. I'm neat because I clean up in meetings after I walk out. I clean up even when it's not my commitment. I straighten out the chairs. It's become my nature. So this alcoholic who stopped drinking, who was a sick, crazy person, full of fear, who thought that I could isolate myself and have money, property, and prestige and hate you, turns out to be a person who's not that way at all. I've got compassion that I never knew I would be able to experience because I thought I would be too sensitive. I didn't want to feel sorrow. I've lost everyone. I've lost the four or five guys that I sat with for 30 years in the same meeting every single solitary week, and they're all gone. And it tortured me, and I had to go to a different meeting. I've lost the woman that I talk to all the time, but I found somebody other people to talk to. You know, I keep moving because I don't know how not to do it. Because at the beginning, that's what you told me. Lila, show up every night. Come to this meeting. Come early. Sit down. Have a commitment. Reach your hand out. I said, but what am I going to say to those people? He said, say what we said to you. My name is Lila. I'm an alcoholic. You will never be thrown out of Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter what you do or who you are, it all belongs in the parking lot, and you bring the alcoholic in here, and we will never exclude you. And if somebody tells you that you have to go, there are 1,000 meetings that you can go to, and I will be there to make sure you can stay. And we have traditions and concepts and steps, and we have a book. And if you're in the fifth year of your sobriety and you don't know that 12 and 12, then you're missing something big. And when you finish with the honesty of the first step and you get that powerlessness, that feeling, and you don't want to be uncomfortable with it, and you get that power back in step two, and you get that hope that comes with that power, you see, I'm a person that can't live without hope now, then I have this faith. I have this faith because I trust it. It took me 5 years every day of saying, please help me to trust you. And I was 30 years sober. And that didn't mean that I didn't have a God. I had a tremendous spiritual connection. I just needed more. I just needed more. I will be continuing to grow one day at a time for the rest of my life. I take an inventory every April. It happens to be the fourth month. 4, 4, 4. I'm easy. Reminds me it's time. Because I want to stay current with myself. I want to stay current. I talk to somebody all the time. I love the sixth step. It says clearly in there, God will not render you white as snow and keep you that way without your cooperation. Scary word for alcoholics, cooperation. Really scary when it finds out all this nonsense about, oh, God's will, you know, it's God's will, you know, whatever. No. Your cooperation, you play a role in this. It clearly states in the big book that God's will is when your will is aligned with God. Your will is to do what you can. You're supposed to do what's possible. God will do what's impossible. I have never had my higher power, the God of my understanding, say no to me. I have heard yes, not at this time, and I have something better in store for you, but I have never heard no, and I have never heard waste. I don't believe in waste. I don't think there's one wasted human being. I don't think there's one wasted thought. I think we all play a role. I don't think there's any special people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we're absolutely all the same. I think that people have time, yes. We have something that we can offer to you, because I get up every morning and I know to be spiritually fit. And I don't get out of bed, and I don't open my eyes, and I don't let the world come in until I have absolutely turned myself over. And I can tell you that in the last 8 years, when I get up in the morning and I ask God to do with me whatever it is that is supposed to happen to me today, it is the most amazing thing, because I am still afraid every morning when I say it. I still have a little bit that maybe God is going to harm me. Maybe there be a little punishment in there somewhere. Maybe there's this, you know, but you know, nothing's happened to me. And yet, all these people have died, and I've had sadness, and there's something going on. And today I had to go back and eat a banana, take a bath, and read the big book. Because I got a phone call that my sister-in-law's, you know, her cancer is back and all of that, and what have you. And I needed to be alone. I needed to be alone. I needed to cry. I needed to say, yes, that's what's happening today, and guess what? It'll be all right. Because we'll get through that too. I will get through absolutely everything that life presents to me. I no longer look in the past at what the problem is. We are all survivors. If you are sober here in this room tonight, you have survived your childhood, you've survived your broken marriages, you've survived it all. It is far more courageous to just live in the day. It is far harder to say, what do I have to do today? I've already got the problem under control. What is the solution for me? The solution for me, if my understanding is to get up in the morning, turn my will and my life over, say the serenity prayer. I work the, say the first three steps, and if I need to go further and go all the way to 12, I will. I know that I am a person suddenly that sees what's right about you, not what's wrong with you. I look at everything, and Beverly said it last night, and I really was looking for a new idea that I could have, because every year I give myself a new idea, Beverly, because I was full of old ideas. And I, too, want to see the presence of God, and I probably need to see the presence of God in other people more than I do anything else. And I'm going to look for that now. But I see what's right. What's right about my life? What's right about the people in my life? What's right about the things I do? What's right about the business, what's right about everything? I'm so sick of spending half of my life looking at what's wrong with everything. That is an old idea. That is like alcoholic thinking. It's just not appropriate. I'm not doing it anymore. If you are not kind to me and you are not gracious to me, I will have nothing to do with you. There'll be other people that will be happy to tell you what to do. It won't be me. I am done. I am done with pretending that it's all right. I am in love with my life. I'm in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in love with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in love with the passion. I want to take all I can from you, because all you give me makes me get through the night, the one night where we will all have it, where at 3 o'clock in the morning you're going to say, is it enough? And it will be. I get down on my knees at the side of my bed. I never thought I would ever do such a thing. I never thought I would ever do such a thing. I want to give it away so much. I want to say, you know, all you have to do in the first few months is show up. Show up. Learn the habits. Find the seat. Drink the lousy coffee. Get the commitment. Put your hand out. Listen, do whatever they want you to do. Now, there's a guy here with Wayne. I don't know. I mean, this is a guy that's really going to any length to say so. It's extraordinary. But this is what it used to be like. There was no questioning it. They didn't want to hear my opinion. There was no interest in what Lila thought. Nothing. And probably the greatest night, maybe in all of my life, in Alcoholics Anonymous, was the night they said to me at the hole in the ground, it's your turn at the door. And when the next newcomer comes in, you take care of them. I have never forgotten that. The responsibility that somebody with a couple of days less than me would need me to help them. I said, oh my God, how am I going to know who's the newcomer? And he said, you're going to know. And sure enough, this guy walks in, and his hand was so wet, both of our hands were slipping all over the room. I thought, this is my man. I said, guess what? You're gonna stay sober. I'm gonna bring you over here and get you this literature, and you're gonna read this thing. And I'm going to call you every single day and night. And then you're going to call me, and any page will do. And you got to carry a dime in your pocket. And there's no reason for you to drink ever again. You never have to do this again. You never have to drink again. You're going to hate the coffee. They're going to say all these crazy things to you. They're going to want you to do all this stuff that their sponsor did, and you have to do it. And then guess what? You're going to be like me. They're going to give somebody like you to me. And we're going to be okay. Because you know what? After this meeting, we're going for coffee. And I'll buy you this coffee tonight, because that's what they did for me. And if you need a sandwich, you know what? We can cough that up too. And if you need, and I really gave the guy the whole drill. And I realized, and I said, there's signs on the wall. Don't worry about them. You're not going to understand them for at least 30 days. And if you don't hear anything that they say, it doesn't make a bit of difference, because there's some sort of grace thing. They call it the grace of God. I'm not sure what it is, but they call it the grace of God. And it's going to sprinkle all over you. And it's almost impossible to drink within the first 30 days. It's just impossible. So don't even worry about it. And I know you feel like you're shaking right now. And this guy's giving me the nod. So you're going to get a Hershey bar and a Coca-Cola, because if you don't drink that, you're going to have a seizure, and then they're going to put a wallet in your mouth and drag you off to the side of the room. But don't worry, they'll bring you right back. They'll bring you right back, and in the meantime, I'll make sure nobody takes your seat. That night in Alcoholics Anonymous was the night I really became a member of AA. The night that I reached out and shared with somebody else, the man is still sober. We talk to each other once a year. We're still sober. And a lot of the people in that room are sober. They're not sober, it's because they're at that big meeting in the sky. And let me tell you, when you're sober as long as I am, a lot of people are in that meeting in the sky. And they're still available. And I can still hear them. And I can still hear telling them, say, listen, Lila, their asses are getting tired from sitting in that seat. Sit down. I hope you have a wonderful rest of the weekend. You're going to be listening to, I'm sure, some great people, and you're going to see each other. Don't ignore the person that's shaking. If you find somebody standing by themselves, let's do the old-fashioned thing and ask them their name and if they have somebody that they need to sit with. You know something? We are dying not just from alcoholism. When you took away the alcohol from me, what was left that occurred 15 and 18 and 20 years later? What was left was the sadness. What was left was the loneliness. What was left was the spiritual deficiency. What was left is that I needed to know that I would never be alone again. I would never be alone again. I never realized that I would have it coming from you in these seats and coming from that great big meeting in the sky. Thank you.